Blog Talk Radio.
For your God is, for your God is come to me. For your God is, for your God is come to me. I need your wisdom for this age. For this age, for your God is, for your God is come to me. For your God is, for your God is come to me.
Well, good evening and welcome, Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. I hope you all had a very nice and happy Ostara celebration. And thanks to those of you who wrote me to say you love the spring meditations that you can access from my website. I really like the one personally with the changing faces of the spring god as he's seated at the knee of the goddess. His face morphs from Tammuz to Osiris to Attis to that final dying and rising god of green things, the vine god, some have called him, and I think some also call him Jesus. Well, a quick shout out to a few of our fans. I want to say hello to Keely. She is in Canada. Keely wrote me and said, I'm a recent Canadian listener to your Blog Talk Radio show. I've listened to several of your wonderful archive pieces, and my main reason for writing you is to implore you to please continue doing what you're doing. I don't know if you get tired or discouraged or if you sometimes can't see the effects of your attempts come to fruition, but I want to assure you that you're affecting change in the people who listen to you and that those people will go on to spread the change in diverse and creative ways. Keely says, over the last week, she's gone through all three of the free guided meditations, and she thanks me so much because they were actually the first guided meditations she's done. And she said she listened to two of the archive shows in a row, and something just shifted in her mind that night. Something shifted away from patriarchy. She says, I'm nervous about sounding like I endorse reverse patriarchy. You know, the same thing, but with women on top, she says. But someone made the point about a woman being the principal being and the man being her son, man coming from woman instead of woman coming from man, from the rib, shall we say. It still feels a little daring and inappropriate for me to say, but what if women are the natural leaders? Not in the same kind of system, but in a way we communicate, the way we interact with one another. What if we do have some unique quality that makes us, or at least gifted representatives of our gender, ideal for guiding humanity to a saner, more peaceful, and cohesive existence? Keely closes her comments by saying, I'm still growing and changing and trying to figure out how to be a woman in this world, but listening to you and your wonderful and informative guests, I feel, is helping me in a very significant way. And I hope you continue to do what you do and that more women and men who need a paradigm shift will be directed to resources like you for the necessary spirit of change. Here's to that 100th monkey, Keely says. And then I want to mention a quick word from Maria. Maria says, hope you're well. Just wanted to say thanks for Voices of the Sacred Feminine. I discovered it in early December when I was off work with the flu, and what a great week I had lying around with my MP3 player plugged into my ears, listening to all your fascinating guests. I listened all through Christmas and New Year's, too, and during a trip to Cyprus in early January, I was very pleased to have you with me when my plane was delayed for 9 hours because of snow. I'm now pacing myself because I've almost finished listening to the archives, and I don't want them to end. That's so nice, Maria. Thank you. And finally, from Deb, Deb says, she just wrote in about last week's show. She says, I love your show with Julie Raymond and David Hillman. I've been very intrigued with cellular genetic memory, so I really got into what Julie had to say. And David is just fantastic. What he has to say about the ancient world makes me makes so much more sense than the pathetic myths Christian translators have given us to read. You see, David, you're making an impression. Even when I was a child, I wondered how people built a society based on such silly stories. I homeschool my kids, and even my 9-year-old daughter has said the same thing. Thanks to people like David and Charlene Spretnak, I feel like I have a framework to really understand what was going on in the ancient world, but also what we've lost in terms of understanding ourselves and the natural world. But I'm optimistic, as I feel we're getting it back as well. And Karen, you ask the best questions. You always ask just what I want to know. So Deb, thank you so very much. Appreciate all you listeners out there. And thanks to our new artists, too, who have generously allowed me to play their music for your enjoyment on the show. For tonight's opening, you just heard Warrior Goddess from the very talented local artist, Lisa Thiel. The theme of the song ties nicely in with part of our guest, David Hillman's subject, Women Who Kick Ass, Warriors of the Sacred Feminine. But if you want more information about the music, Lisa's website is www.sacreddream.com. You'll be hearing a lot more of her music because I really love everything she does. And at the bottom of the hour, for a more ethereal sound for our closing prayer, you'll get to hear new music by Leah Scallion, and her CD is The Sounds of Sirius. Now, we have a change of lineup tonight. We were going to have, at the top of the hour, the cultural historian and foremother of goddess spirituality, author of The Once and Future Goddess, Eleanor Gadden. Now, I'm not sure what happened to Eleanor. This is the second time she's booked herself on the show and the second time something's come up. But fortunately, I'm very lucky that David was scheduled for the bottom of the hour, and he's going to be coming in early tonight. So I thank him so very much for being generous with his time and so flexible. David is coming back to continue our ongoing conversation about what the Greeks were trying to teach us before the lens of Christianity distorted our understanding of their insights and beliefs. We'll use the movie that opened this weekend, The Clash of the Titans, as part of the backdrop for that conversation, just as we promised. And I also have some questions that were emailed in. I think we'll be touching on the women of the Dionysus cults, who David calls the women who kindle the flame, and as previously mentioned, those women who kick ass, warriors of the sacred feminine. Hence that opening song by Lisa Thiel, Warrior Goddess. I played it just for this occasion. And it seems like when you hear the topics for What's the Buzz and considering what's at the heart of what David and I are going to talk about, it seems like really the core theme is about lost and distorted knowledge and history. And we want to be sure to remember, lest we forget. So our What's the Buzz topics tonight, some of those are going to be new news about the Virginia governor, Robert McDonnell. He made a proclamation today that April is going to be Confederate History Month. But it might sound like an okay thing, but when you look closer, he's really just pandering to the underlying racial hatred, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Another thing we'll talk about tonight is how people always want to rewrite history. We knew about the Texas Board of Education. We know about George Bush and his cronies do it all the time, Fox News, blah, blah, blah. Well, Karma Burgum has sent in something I'm going to share with you about not forgetting 9/11. We're going to just briefly go over from Ms. Magazine's blog what the health care bill means for women. And also from the Ms. Magazine blog, what Proposition 8 defenders don't want you to know. That's going to be really interesting, how we're going to reveal deliberate efforts to mislead voters about the negative consequences of legalized same-sex marriage. And Sarah Palin, she is on the agenda tonight, too. She's going to be back on TV, so we're going to discuss, is there any harm in that? And finally, some comments for Bart Stupak. Remember, he was the guy holding the health care bill hostage to try to get stronger abortion restrictions in the bill. So we are going to, just kind of ask him how it feels to have some of the people that or on his side in this abortion fight, to be treating him like the health care providers for women have been treated by the anti-choice folks. So those are some of the things that we're going to cover in What's the Buzz tonight. But first, I have one announcement, a schedule change for this month I want to make sure everyone's aware of. We're not going to have a show next Wednesday because Roy and I will actually be on a much-needed vacation. So next week, no show. The following Wednesday, though, will be our Earth Day show on April 21st, and our guest is Burl Hall. He's the author of Sophia's Web, and he is going to talk about subjects appropriate for Earth Day. Then on Monday, April 26th, I'm making up for the show that we missed that week, so it's a Monday show instead of a Wednesday show, and David is going to be back with us, I'm glad to say, and then we will finish out the month with Max Dashow, author of The Suppressed Histories Archives. All right, so it's about time to get to our guest, David Hillman. I'm sure most of you know him and have been anxiously awaiting for him to return. David is a way shower. He is a scholar. He is a servant of the muses. And I would like to read his bio for you, just in case you might be new to who he is. David earned an MS in bacteriology, I never can say that, and an MA and PhD in classics from the University of Wisconsin, where he was asked to remove a chapter about recreational drugs from his dissertation on Roman pharmacy. A lesson learned in how academia might sacrifice truth not to upset traditional standards of belief, he did so, but went on to publish his findings that made academia so uncomfortable with St. Martin's Press in 2008, the result being his book, The Chemical Muse, Drug Use and the Roots of Western Civilization. He's currently working on a second book concerned with drugs, women, and the foundations of Western civilizations, and has recently been invited to present his findings at Boston University, where classicists now recognize the reality of recreational drug use by ancient Greeks and Romans. Well, David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here, really. And tonight we're gonna get people worked up, I think.
Okay. Well, they're hoping for that. You know, you certainly have that talent. You're a lot of fun. I appreciate you so much. So let's see. Where do you want to start? We're going to use Clash of the Titans as a backdrop for you know, the topic of how the history of the Greeks has been distorted. Do you want to start there, or
Sure. Let's start there, and we'll save the really good stuff for later. Let's talk about the Clash and how to get rid of it.
Well, you know, I want to mention to readers, please go to my Examiner column because David wrote a wonderful article, and that's actually the title of it. Let me find it here. You've Got the Clash and Can't Get Rid of It, Commentary on the New Movie and Lost Knowledge. And, you know, I ran that, you know, David's rant and posted it there because, as I say in the article, as an activist myself, I'm appalled how close we came to losing the history of the sacred feminine. We've seen during Women's History Month what gaping holes there are in the history of half of humanity. Without the fairness doctrine, every day we watch the gullible as they're duped, as their bigotry is used to manipulate them to stand against their economic and social interests and that of their neighbors. Commentators on Fox even admit they don't want to evolve. Neutrality of the internet is actually being threatened. Truth is under assault. Knowledge is being lost. And I don't think I'm exaggerating here. Our understanding of history fades with each generation. It's a tragedy befitting the rants of ancient poets, and perhaps our modern bards might take up the case. And that's just what you're doing, Dr. Hillman, and I thank you.
Well, you know, if anybody's going to save Western civilization here and bring back the history that actually existed, it's the voice of women that's going to do it, and I'll talk about that. And I'm convinced of that, and I'm convinced that that's the pattern the Greeks left for us and that we strayed from. But how about the Clash? Let's talk about the Clash.
Okay, let's go to the Clash. Well, you know, if You know, the Greeks, you know, if the Greeks, the gods were really essences and elements and forces of nature, I guess one of the questions I had about the movie, when we see Poseidon, Zeus, and Hades, these men fighting siblings, how do we actually see them the way the Greeks saw them? I mean, they weren't actually men, like you said, with arms, legs, genitals. What did this chaos between the siblings, the rivaling siblings, actually represent without the Christian lens?
Yeah, you know, so we go in the theater and we sit down and we see Zeus come out in his way too shiny uniform, you know, and he's sparkling and whatnot, and he's talking to his buddies there at Olympus. And after about 10 minutes, we start to think the Greeks were really stupid people, because who in the world would think that this is what reality was? And it's a fact that that's because we're looking at the Greek psyche through the Christian lens, and that's why we see it that way. Let me just give you one example. The word for God in Greek, this is interesting, the word for God in Greek, people ignore this, but in ancient Greek, theos, the word for God or goddess, by the way, it's gender neutral, so it can be a god or a goddess. It's our distinction. We make it the distinction between god and goddess. They just thought of theos in general. But what's it mean? What does the word God mean? Well, literally, if you go, and I'm not just pulling this out of my hat, if you go to Herodotus, who's a Greek historian, 5th century historian, he describes it for us. He says, what does it mean? It just means an arranger or a disposer, somebody who, it's essentially from the word meaning to limit or to define something. So when the Greeks are talking about their gods, then the example I like to use is music. Music will be around after you and I are gone, and after the planet is gone, and Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad are all vaporized in the future. On some other planet, some other creature will evolve and ultimately pick up a reed from where he sits or she sits and blow into it, and they'll make music and think, aha, and then they'll put words to it. And voila, music is born again, because it's immortal. It's an immortal concept, and that's really what the Greeks thought of their gods, was that they were the immortal principles that governed the universe.
So was there any significance to the fact that you had this sibling rivalry between them, and that they wanted to overpower their so-called, mother and father? I mean, or is that just a literary device, or are the Greeks trying to tell us something that we've lost?
Yeah, you know, one of the greatest Greek philosophers said that nobody, Heraclitus is his name, nobody said, people like Homer and Hesiod, they didn't believe that the gods had arms and legs, and don't fool yourself into thinking that they did. So how could they have sibling rivalries? Well, it's the same thing. We think about, for example, Zeus and Kronos, and later Greeks tell us that Kronos is actually another word for time. It's a different spelling, but they argue it themselves. So if you think about time and the forces of nature battling time, the mother of Zeus is Rhea, right? She's really the important one. What does her name mean? And if you look at all the Greek gods, their names all mean something. And we miss that in English. We miss it because we don't really know, we can't really grasp what they were doing. But Rhea, and this is great for your audience, because Rhea is extremely important. Rhea is one of these titaness, one of these titan gods. What does her name mean? It just means flowing, like a river flows. So eventually, the flowing of the universe was able to conquer time through the birth of the council, through the birth of knowledge, through the birth of the modern era. Time was ultimately conquered. Time was oppressing. The Greeks picture it as time is a great titan who oppresses the earth and the sky. And if you think about it, the Greeks were no fools. They're the ones who actually sat around talking about things like the expanding universe and evolution. People don't know it, but the first evolutionary theory came out of Greece. And they knew that the earth, as the womb of everything, as the producer of everything, they knew that for a long time she lay dormant. and that ultimately from this womb a flowing proceeded, and from this flowing time was ultimately defeated by the creation of a new existence, the creation of humanity, the creation of all the Olympian principles, music and dance and reason. That these are, you know, you didn't have this when the earth was first sitting around, according to the Greeks. You didn't have it.
So then, David, what you're saying is Poseidon, Zeus, and Hades, these Olympians, they're what they really represent, again, not men. We have to get out of that Christian thinking box, personifying the gods. Poseidon, Zeus, and Hades, they're really ushering in a new age, a new way of living on the earth. That's sort of the big concept.
Right, exactly. One that's easy, maybe easiest to grasp. The two gods, Apollo and Artemis, they really are the gods of reason in this age. Artemis is beautiful. People don't think about Artemis, and this is what's so great is Artemis. She's actually the leader of the chorus. She's the one who strikes up the chorus. This group of women, who will dance and sing poetry around an altar. They're telling a story about things that we call myths. They're telling these myths around the altar. They're performing dances that are supposed to reflect geometry and astronomy. It's really beautiful stuff. And Artemis is the leader of these dancers. She is reason. She is the ability that these dancers are able to, that these, you know, upright monkeys are able to take their understanding of the stars and translate them into words. That's Artemis's job. That's where she comes in. That's her beauty. And so that reason was impossible eons ago when the only thing that existed was earth and sky and time. That's all that existed. And so humanity ultimately had to break through via goddesses like Artemis. So do you see the beauty there? Do you see what they were trying to capture?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I find that, and even though you tell me over and over again, I have to really retrain my Christianized mind, you know, and I'll get these aha moments, you know, and I'll go, okay, I get it now, you know. I get it that, you know, these gods were indifferent to man because they weren't people, you know. They were phenomena. They were essences. They were whatever it is you would call reason and music, they were, you know, they were these qualities, and it's hard to keep my mind wrapped around that because I've been thinking the other way so long.
Exactly, and you know, the Greeks had it, and we do that. We tend to do that. We look at antiquity because, let's face it, Karen, we're a generation who worships a man.
Right.
I mean, that's what it comes down to. Jesus had testicles and a penis and walked around and you know, relieved himself now and then. So the Greeks actually laughed at the fact, the pagans we would call them, actually laughed at the fact that Christians worshiped the guy. They thought that was funny. And it was odd to them that you could worship something so low, something so, you know,
as common as man.
Exactly. Something that had a birth and a death. They thought that was goofy. Why would you worship that when you could worship the beauty of the cosmos, you know,
right,
geometry.
Right. Well, you know, that makes perfect sense to me now. I mean, I can really see it, but I can also see how, you know, your average guy in the field who, you know, sows the soil for a living, I don't know, do you think it was easier for him to understand the way the Greeks thought of the immortals, or do you think it was easier for him to see a man in the sky?
You know, that's a great question. That's a great question. I don't have an answer for that, Karen. The only thing I can say, maybe remotely somewhat of an answer, but not really, is think of the American Indians, think of the Native Americans, who also developed the same understanding of sky and earth and the creative process. Was it an attachment to the land? Was it an attachment to nature? I think definitely it was. There was a closeness. There was a reverence in antiquity. There was a reverence for the natural world. And, you know, we don't see that. Back to the Clash. We don't see that in the Clash. We see a lot of guys running around with their big uniforms and their ridiculously painted you know, abdomens and their swords. It feels like somebody took a bunch of testosterone and shot you up with it before you went in the studio.
Well, you know what Zeus looked like? I don't know if you ever saw the movie Excalibur, which was about King Arthur, but that's how, you know, that's how all the knights looked, you know.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing I thought of. But what some of my listeners have emailed me in to say is they were angry because, you know, there was no role for the goddesses in this at all. And in the original, the old Clash of the Titans that you can probably still catch on TV, that, you know, that real elementary kindergarten form of 3D that was out back then, I think there was, you know, the goddesses played a bigger role in what was going on in this story.
Yeah, and, you know, that's a symptom of a larger problem with how we understand myth, myth of antiquity, is that women played a much more significant role than even scholars are willing to admit. And this really makes me angry because people don't see, when you actually start reading this stuff, when you actually start reading these ancient texts, even just the tragedies, Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides, when you actually start reading these things, you realize, oh my God, they're all about women. What's going on? What? I don't understand. I thought they were all misogynists. You know, we say that about Euripides. He was a misogynist, but he's writing about a bunch of women, and it's all about the virtue of women. So
David, when all right, you're saying you know that they're writing about women because we know you can translate the text yourself. Is it the people who are reading translations done by Christians that have this distorted view that women were minor players?
Yeah, it's half and half. It's half of that, and it's half of the academic world trying to perpetuate something that they back a corner that they painted themselves into. Let me give you an example. There's a book called The Delphic Oracle. It's Early History, Influence, and Fall. And it's published by Cambridge, I believe it is. And they Cornell University Press. And they this author talks about the fall of the oracle, and why did this oracle of Delphi, what was wrong with the priestess, and there are all sorts of problems. And it just, as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, well, this doesn't jibe with any of the actual text that I've read. If you turn to the title page, you'll find out it's written by a Reverend Dempsey. Well, there you go, with an M.A. Okay.
Right.
That's the problem, is that the history has been written by the Christians, and as the pagans said, as the Christians were taking over, you've got to stop the Christians from teaching classical literature because they put it into their own terms, and that's the problem, and that's what Christians do.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. They make the gods of antiquity. They make a man gods. You know, they make a man and woman gods. They don't understand really what was going on. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, in two points I want to make. First of all, what you're saying, you know, this when you went to the front of the book and you saw it was written by, you know, a Christian scholar, it reminded me so much when the Da Vinci Code came out and they had all of those troop squads that were just going berserk. And you really had to look close and look in the credits, or sometimes there were little things that gave it away. But the ones that were so anti-Da Vinci Code were always financed by Christians. And the ones that were much more open-minded and were willing to look at things, you know, and consider new ideas, they weren't, you know, financed by Christians. It's the same thing. You know, it just keeps happening over and over again. And to go back to what you were saying about, you know, the role of women in ancient times, you know, wasn't quite so oppressive as some would say. I know you've sort of stirred up a controversy on my Examiner column, which has been great. I love the dialogue back and forth. I mean, I'm for the truth. I want to see both sides. You know, I want to have the dialogue, have the conversation. And I've had other scholars email me and say, you know, in the East, you know, it depends on when you're talking about, where you're talking about, because a lot of ancient women in, you know, that were in Turkey and part of the Middle East, you know, they weren't, you know, as oppressed as women were in other parts of the world. So, you know, we have to look at the whole picture, you know, I think, not just isolated areas.
Right.
I'm not the scholar you are, but that's where, you know, that's the hypothesis that's starting to form in my head anyway as I listen to all the different voices.
Right. Anytime you say make a blanket statement about history, you're going to be corrected because it's history changes and it's fluid. And what I can tell you, Karen, from what I've studied, and I'm studying early archaic Greece, pre-classical Greece, and I'm telling you for a fact, I can show you, the evidence is all there, I can show you that women had a much different role in society. As a matter of fact, they were the founders. There's a great balance in archaic Greece between the male martial element of society and the female intellectual element of society. Now, I hate to admit this because I'm a man, but it looks like from earliest archaic Greece, it looks like that women were actually the movers and shakers of the intellectual aspects of Greek society, Greek culture. They were the ones who invented medicine. They were the ones who invented pharmacy. They were the ones who pushed society toward democracy consistently, as democracy was slowly boiling, seething in Greece, and ultimately came to expression in the 5th century in Athens. They were the ones who were pushing this, and you can see it consistently. And those are the facts. And if the facts are that these women were leaders of society, then we have to let that. We have to talk about that. Instead, what we get in popular culture is some guy with a silly looking costume, stabbing at a snaky haired, half snake woman monster, right?
Well, we've talked about Medusa before, but let's just briefly talk about her one more time because she keeps coming up. She came up in the movie. We've talked about her before. And I know you're trying to help me understand Medusa a little bit more, and you were explaining to me, and I'm going to read what you wrote to me. Medusa was portrayed as a woman in the earliest Greek text. She was an oracular priestess who probably served as a bodyguard for the oracles, represented as the Daughters of Night, one of the earliest oracle cults. Poseidon is also an oracular divinity. His union with Medusa is the mythical preservation of the history of oracles in Greece. So we have this ugly image of Medusa and Poseidon, Poseidon raping Medusa, when it's not really an ugly thing at all. And like you've told me, they create, their union also creates the Pegasus.
Correct. And Pegasus ultimately carries the lightning to Zeus, right? That becomes his job.
And the lightning is enlightenment. Am I remembering that correctly?
Exactly. It is the age of Zeus ultimately takes over the oracular responsibilities of the other gods. And this is what I'm arguing this. You won't see this in modern classical texts, but what I'm arguing is, and there's plenty of evidence to show it, that the earliest Greek religions were all oracular in nature. And that's why I talk about the cult of Night as being one of the earliest. She is one of these Titaness goddesses. She is one of these early divinities. And you see this is what's so beautiful that your audience needs to understand, is that these early gods have actually such veneration, such respect in our oldest texts like Hesiod. These goddesses like Night, Black Night. People keep, moderns ignore this goddess Black Night. But she is actually the source of the fates. She is the source of the Moira that we talked about. She is the one who brings forth. And people say, why Night? Why worship Night? Well, this will get us right back into Dionysus as well. Women are associated in antiquity, particularly with nighttime worship. And this is odd because why would this be a feminine thing? Well, remember in antiquity, particularly archaic antiquity, we're talking about peoples who followed the lunar calendar as opposed to the solar. And so why would they do that? Why would the lunar month be so important? Well, and why is it associated with women? I won't give you the answer. I'll just keep giving you the clues, and we can all figure it out on our own. But you have women now who are going out in the nighttime to perform sacred rites in celebration of things like night, in celebration of the moon and the cycle of the moon. And this is a time when they're said to go out by themselves. These gatherings are illegal for men. Women can actually kill men if they're caught at these gatherings. That's early on attested And we'll talk about that as well in Euripides. But so women are going out at night collecting their herbs that they're using to do what? To draw down the moon, right? To control the moon. So we get the worship of Hecate and the whole idea of how to control the menstrual cycle based upon an understanding of plants that will essentially cause sloughing of the uterine lining.
Mm-hmm.
And abortions.
Right, right.
So you've got women out at night in these early, early archaic Greek cults who are almost a reflection, I'm guessing, they're a reflection of the earlier pre-agricultural human societies where women would congregate in these kind of medical/religious contexts where they would teach each other about how to control and manipulate their cycles based upon a whole mythology of the moon, their worship of the moon.
So the science and the religion and their bodies, I mean, it's all interrelated. I mean, there's really no dividing line. It all just overlaps and runs together.
Yeah, imagine that when women were in charge of religion, that it was all a synthesis of science and psychology and history and government, that it was all a synthesis of this, that these same women who were able to, and I think that's suited to the female mind. I think I'm sorry if that doesn't strike anybody as well, but I think that's a reflection of the female psyche, that women were able in these early cults to actually synthesize everything into a kind of a coherent system.
Well, it makes sense to me, David, you know, in at least from my monkey brain, that, you know, because we talk about, you know, women look at things big picture, how what they do affects their family, their community, where men tend to be a little bit more tunnel vision. So I don't know, maybe that's oversimplifying it, but that's what you made me think of when you were describing the synthesis.
Well, no, I don't think that's oversimplified. I think that's it in a nutshell. And I think these women, it's important for us to understand that these women who were following these early oracular cults, and that's kind of where I got on this sidetrack, these women who were following these early oracular cults ultimately become the judges of early Greek society. So law itself, themis and dike, those things actually come from this female movement. It's a female-only movement. And if you're gonna question that, we'll jump into the Dionysus as well, where it becomes really obvious that women were indeed the dispensers of justice.
So, all right. So let me ask you this, and again, maybe the answer is it depends on where we're talking about when. But was it just Christianity that demoted these women, or was there also, you know, maybe some patriarchal Greeks that were resisting, you know, and said, oh, too much power in the hands of one gender or something like that?
Well, you know what, despite, you always have the oracles up until the Christian church actually dissolves them. So the oracles exclusively as women still exist, and the big three are Dodona, Delphi, and Amon, and Siwa, which is in Egypt. So you still have those oracles existing and practicing. These are women who are giving out messages from the gods. These women still practice all the way up until Christianity. So the Greeks never actually cut them off. It was actually the Christians who did that. And they did so on purpose because the oracle said Christianity is a terrible thing and it's got to go or we're going to society is going to crumble as we know it.
Wise women.
and the Christians were smart for targeting them because they were really the linchpin in antiquity that would have kept paganism going had Christianity not toppled them. So, but no, I won't say the Greeks did not have tendencies to suppress that feminine power because it waxes and wanes with time. In the archaic period, it's really, really is at its peak, and it does wax with time, but the Greeks had no desire to overthrow the female voice simply because they understood balance. And this is pretty consistent throughout Greek history, even late Hellenistic Greek history, that the Greeks understood that there was an element of the woman's voice that shouldn't be stifled, that if you did, you were stifling nature, and you can't do that.
Nature's life.
Right.
I want to take 1 minute and give listeners our call-in number just in case someone might want to call and chat with you, David. The number is 718-766-4662, 718-766-4662. You are welcome to call. I know a lot of our listeners do listen from the archives, but if you're listening live, please do call us and ask David your questions. Now, David, talking about the Oracle sites, I remember reading one person on the Examiner column, I think, mentioned, they weren't agreeing with your idea that, you know, women were more powerful and weren't so oppressed. And I think they brought up some sort of, I should have read this before I asked, but I think they said something about at Delphi, the Apollo cults. Were they trying to oppress women there, or am I remembering that comment right? Is there some validity to that?
Yeah, that's the commenter was Max Dasher. I think you've got her on your show next week, and she was trying to point out the Delphic oracles. You were saying I was wrong because the Delphic oracle was a male-only oracle, and we're talking about the masculine overcoming of the feminine in the oracle. She also said that it was that only men could approach the oracle, and that's not true. And I won't use my own self as a source. I'll use Joan Brett Connolly. Dr. Connolly wrote an excellent book called Portrait of a Priestess, Women and Ritual in Ancient Greece, published with Princeton, and in that she says states explicitly that we know that women had to have been able to approach the oracle because, number one, Euripides said they did, and number two, a lot of the oracular responses are about, and we have these things preserved, a lot of the oracular responses are about gynecology. So it would be highly odd for men to be asking about why they're bleeding excessively
right
this month, and how to, you know, what plants can I use to get rid of the bleeding or whatnot. So so we know that women had access to these things. Not only that, but there's also a great priestess that Dr. Connolly talks about who was voted specific open. She had basically the ear of the oracle anytime she wanted because I think she was a priestess of Athena. And she was considered to be so well-respected in the community that she had a special relationship with the oracle. So it's just wrong. And let me step back. Remember these oracles. This is what's so amazing. We talk about the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi. And this is what's so amazing. People from all over the world, the old world, we'll say, came to this woman. At times there were several of them, but there was one. Originally, and they would come to these women to ask them questions about whether or not they could found colonies, whether or not, hey, so-and-so the tyrant is really being a screwball and wherever, Ephesus, and what do we do about him? And she would say, execute him if you want freedom. So people were coming from all over the world to talk to these women. They weren't coming to talk to men, and that's what's so beautiful about this is that the voice of the sacred feminine was preserved in this institution of the oracles, and it's I'm amazed that women, and I hope some women call in tonight, because it's amazing that women today don't see their own sacred voice. They don't see that humanity has preserved for centuries this idea that there is within woman a power, a natural power that allows her to be able to approach the divine more closely than a man. I'm sorry, but that's what.
So how are so many? Look, I mean, I know a lot of a lot of my friends or dear friends are feminist scholars. They have devoted their life to this. How are they missing what you are seeing?
Number one, because they're reading the secondary sources. They're reading histories. They're not going back to the original sources. And if they are going back to the original sources and just reading the actual Greek literature, they're doing it most of the time in translation, okay? Now, that cuts out about 90%. So that takes about 90% of women study scholars there who are subject to basically the Christian lens. Now, what about the classicists then who can read the Greek? Because there are classicists all over this country who can read the Greek. Why are they missing the picture? And what I'm saying is, if you look at the Greek, if you look at how the Greek is translated, our number one translation aid into English is the Oxford Lexicon. It's a huge tome. It's the authority on the Greek language. And if you look, there are, I think, seven Greek words that are translated all as mind. Okay, and this bothered me as a graduate student. I thought, how can I have seven words for the same thing? Doesn't that mean that we're translating it improperly? And sure enough, if you take each of these words and you start to see it repeatedly in context in ancient Greek, you see that they have different meanings. They have different nuances,
mm-hmm.
and you can capture these nuances. So what I'm saying that classes have done is they have relied too much on basically 19th century European men who thought that they could translate this Greek into a Christian, like the word, there's no word for sin. I'm sorry, there's no word for sin in ancient Greek. It doesn't exist.
Well, you said to me when we were talking about the movie, a good indicator that if you're reading a myth or you're seeing one of these Greek myths told on television or the theater, if they talk about sin, forgiveness, redemption, that's a red flag right there that you're getting a Christianized version of what's going on.
Exactly right. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, you're probably watching the duck. And
because that's not part of the Greek paradigm.
No, there is no concept in ancient Greece. I defy any classicist out there to find it. You won't. There is no idea in ancient Greek of sin. There are ideas of missing the mark, of falling short, of offending the gods, of being hubristic, of being having no shame, but there is no concept of sin. Here's another perfect example. In the classicists, this will catch them. Here we go. Ready? There is no word in ancient Greek for homosexual. Now, much of your audience is probably going to be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of gay stuff in ancient literature. Well, yeah, there is, but there's no word for homosexuality or homosexual. There's no word for it. The concept of different sexes, different types of people being different, having sexual persuasions, that doesn't exist. Okay.
Came natural to you was natural.
Well, that and look, a woman can have sex with a woman just like she can have sex with a man.
Right.
Does that make her a different woman? No, she's a woman.
Right.
That's what she is. Is by nature she is a woman. The fact.
So
that
they don't label her differently because of maybe her sexuality. She's so the Christians have added this extra label.
Right, and it's not so much even they don't label her. They couldn't fathom the idea of lesbian, for example. We have our modern word, our English word lesbian, because of Sappho, the great poet, the great lesbian poet. Now, she talks about, it's obvious that she had close relationships with women. And you see this in some of the Greek myths as well, with Athena, for example. You see the what we call a homosexual relationship between two women. And so, therefore, we associate the island of Lesbos with Sappho, and therefore we think of lesbianism, two women
right.
together. But this is not something the Greeks thought of. A woman can have sex with a woman just like she can a man. It's a natural phenomenon. Guess what? Two women can cause each other to reach orgasm just like a man and a woman can cause each other to reach orgasm. There's no natural division.
And it's not a sin.
right. No, there's right. It's not a sin. No. Exactly. Because there's no concept of sin. Right. But it just fits nature. That's the way it is. If it's possible and nature has endowed human beings with the capacity of doing it, then you can't label it and put them in a group. The reason we have homosexuality at all is because of Christianity. The Christians came along, and that was their big thing, was creating a group of people that they could ultimately persecute. And
last time we talked, though, you said that the pagans, though, did draw the line at pedophilia. They didn't care about what we call homosexuality. The pedophilia was definitely a no-no, which we saw happening in the early Christian church.
Right. And that you don't. That's a natural thing. Again, remember, human beings should not have sex, and their doctors, the physicians, talk about this. That human beings should not have sex before puberty, it's actually damaging to them, physically damaging to them. So before puberty was out. Once a person is developed physically, and a woman is cycling properly, then they're culturally allowed to go ahead and engage in sexual intercourse. So that was their, they drew the line at what they thought was the natural law.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question about the oracles again, because you mentioned to me, you know, we were talking about Perseus and how Perseus kills the Medusa, and you thought it was interesting that she was, you know, perhaps killed by Perseus, this, you know, this pseudo-prince, and you thought that maybe, I think you alluded to the fact that there was, you probably gave a bad oracle to a corrupt political figure, but this idea brought up the concept that, like, Alexander, for instance, also mistreated the oracles. I'm not sure we plan to talk about that, but is that something that lives at the front of your brain? You can sort of explain that to me a little bit more?
Sure. So Hesiod, one of our earliest poets, he's roughly contemporary with Homer. He's the one who talks about Medusa and her origin a little bit, and I think he's the best source. And he pictures her as a woman who's one of these oracular priestesses. And again, that's why she joins with Poseidon, right? And a lot of people think, Karen, that these gods are running around raping these women, mortal women or divine females. And there are some rape. There are abductions. When I say rape, I mean abduction. There are some abductions, and there are definitely unwanted advances. That's there. But a lot of this coupling is also consensual. It's more of a design to show you the joining. Again, it's a natural principle, the joining of two things. Anyway, so we have the joining of Poseidon and Medusa. So what would she have been doing? What was Medusa doing? Well, that's where the whole snaky, and again, I'm getting a little bit into the book that I'm working on, so I probably shouldn't give this away, but I love your audience so much, and I think that what you're doing, Karen, is genuine, and I think you're really trying to help women, and so I'm gonna tell you anyway. We have the snaky-haired Medusa, right? Well, the word Medusa just means guardian, that's all, and even men are called Medusae. So, this one guardian, who was said to have the snaky hair, right? Why does she? Well, again, we get to the Bacchants; it's the same thing. What are these people doing with the snaky hair stuff? Well, I can show that what they were doing was that they were using snakes, snake venom specifically, as a drug, and that they had a natural
immunity.
Well, they had a relative immunity because of the protein that they were ingesting, and they were gaining immunity to it, but they were also using it in a way that they would add it to oils, and these oils, again, rose oil is one of them. It looks, and we can talk about Nicander if you want a source. I'll tell you Nicander for that one, but if you, these women were mixing these venoms with these oils, and then they were putting them in their hair. And so that's where we really see the association of, and they were doing it on purpose. Remember, these are bodyguards. These Medusae mm-hmm. are bodyguards, and they were supposedly bodyguards that could turn men to stone. And so if you look at how they were using these neuroparalytic toxins, they were using them on arrows as well. But for some reason, they were putting them in their hair, and that they were could use them on arrows to paralyze people who were endangering the actual oracular priestess. So in antiquity, in archaic Greece, you have these priestesses who are declared to be the oracle of the god, and then petitioners will come in. They'll go through a ceremony of sorts, kind of a cleansing, and then they'll approach the oracle with their question.
Mm-hmm.
And when they approach the oracle, some of them would get a little bit violent, like Alexander the Great did because he was a bonehead. And these Medusae then would be required to stop the men in their tracks. And it looks like that... these oracles would sometimes tell these petitioners, if they were princes and prominent people, they would tell them things that they didn't want to hear. For example, Herodotus tells us that one group approached the oracle, and she said, no, you can't have what you want. I think they wanted a war with somebody else. She said, no, you can't have what you want until you rebuild the temple of Athena that you destroyed. They had to go back to their homeland, and they had to rebuild this temple of Athena. Then they had to go back and ask, well, now can we have our war? Well, so sometimes these oracles would say things that the petitioners didn't want to hear.
Right.
And ultimately what looks like is happening is sometimes the oracles were getting killed historically. And it looks like that's probably what happened with the Medusa myth as well, that there was, that's why she's killed, her head is cut off and whatnot.
So because she said the wrong thing to the wrong person.
Right. Perseus didn't like what he heard originally because he said, tells us she's just a woman, right? He didn't say she's a creepy snaky goddess thingy. He says that she's a woman who's murdered.
So I don't know if I've asked you this before, but you're talking about the oracles makes me think you may have a different answer than I'm accustomed to for this. You know how you always hear that the oracles spoke in these. You know, it was sort of undiscernible that the priests had to decipher what they said. Is that another view through the Christian lens?
That's BS. It's not the Christian lens. It may be. I can't call it that, but it's Plutarch. Plutarch gives us a whole bunch of, he's a late source, and he gives us a whole bunch of malarkey that we know is wrong. And one of the things he talks about is the oracle just jibber-jabbering. That's garbage because we know the earliest archaic Greek oracles were all that they would, when they gave their oracles, they were poetic, and they were specifically in hexameter. That's the poetry that was used by Homer, for example. And this is before Homer. So these poetesses, these oracles, are actually giving responses in poetic form. And Herodotus himself, the Greek historian, he actually lists what the oracles say, and it's not jibber jabber. It's poetry. And he lists oracle after oracle. There are dozens of oracles. If you go to Herodotus' histories, open it up, you'll find there are dozens of oracles in there, and they're all poetic. They're all in meter, and they're all composed by these choruses of female, essentially dancers.
So, David, why are the later scholars or writers, why are they less reliable? Is it just because time has gone on and memory fades just like us today?
Yeah, you know, there's a good 1,000 years difference between when these late authors are writing about it and when the early stuff is actually being, when this early poetry is being composed. So you have to always look back and say, okay, when you're talking about somebody like Plutarch, you could say, okay, what were his sources? What was he using? You know, was he using earlier authors, and who were those earlier authors using? And so it's always easiest to go back. As a scholar, you can get lazy, but it's always easiest to go back just to the earliest sources you can possibly find and say, well, for the earliest stuff, this is what we can say. And whether or not it's contemporary, if it's contemporary, we say, okay, at least we know that this person who lived at the time said this about it. We don't know if it's accurate, but this is what they said. And that contradicts what this dude who lived 1,000 years later said, you know, by a mile, because, you know, it's obviously way off the mark in later antiquity. So,
you know, you need to write a book that just dispels all of the garbage. You know, this is what they taught you. This is what you probably believe, but that's not true. Here's the earlier source.
Right, exactly. I mean, imagine reading, trying to figure out what happened in 2010 based upon some historian who's writing in 3010.
Right.
How much are they going to miss about, you know, how much are they going to miss about the nuances of what's going on? Anyway, go ahead.
Well, and you wonder, too, I mean, is it just like today? I mean, like we have Fox News and the GOP who has their agenda, so they're spouting their so-called truth, even though they know it's a lie. Do you think, to a certain extent, that went on back then, too? They were promoting an agenda rather than what really happened?
Yeah, that's actually, when you're studying an ancient author, you have to ask yourself, what is this person? We don't call it an agenda, but you kind of say, what is the context in which they're writing, and are they writing for a purpose? Are they trying to persuade you of something? What are their influences? So yeah, that's a part of history, is finding out, you know, was this person biased? Were they a priest, you know, or were they not a priest and they're writing about priests? So how much does that mean they know about priests if they weren't one actually themselves?
Right, right.
So,
well, let me ask you about the and I know I didn't plan to ask you this, so if you need to look it up or something, just say pass. But
okay.
You know, when you said abductions and that sort of thing, in your mind, from your original sources, what was the real thing that was happening when Hades supposedly abducts Persephone?
Yeah, that's actually a real abduction. That's one of them that I define as, and the Greek defines as an abduction. That's what it says. He snatched her away, and that was the earth opens up and Persephone is sitting there. We notice that she's sitting there picking flowers with her with a group of girls her age, Parthenoi, young women of marriageable age. So she's with them picking flowers, and again she's not just picking flowers. She's actually all the plants that are named, and I've looked at this. The plants that are named for example in the hymn to Demeter, from the Homeric hymn to Demeter, all the plants that are mentioned are medicinal plants. So Leopian poppy, for example, you know, she's out messing around with opiates, right? And that's symbolic of something that's got to have some cultural meaning there. But she's actually taken away. She's actually snatched away, put in the chariot, and taken away taken from her mother. And I think that's what this story is really emphasizing there. So that is a rape. That is what we call a rape, in other words.
Okay, so that's not, you know, one of the philandering Zeus with all his women kind of a story. This one has, it's more accurate. There's not a double meaning there.
Yeah, it's not that it's more accurate. It's very specific in the Greek that she's actually snatched, that she's actually taken by force. So when we talk about Zeus coupling with Maia, for example, let's take Maia, this goddess of the, who lives in this cave, and she refuses to live with other goddesses, and she's this divinity who speaks from the cave, right? She joins with Zeus. It's literally joined. She joins with Zeus, and through her joining of Zeus, they produce Hermes. Well, if you look at Maia's traits, and you look at Zeus's traits, and then you look at their child Hermes' traits, Hermes is just a combination of Zeus and Maia, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this with all the so Zeus then also joins with Mnemosyne. So some of your female audience should pay attention to this. Mnemosyne means memory, right?
When
Zeus, the one who holds the lightning bolt, the enlightenment, when he joins with memory, what do you get? Inspiration. You get the muses. They're born. And so you can see it doesn't have to do with sex anymore. You know,
Right.
It was a way for the Greeks to describe what was going on in the universe as they saw it through terms that monkey people like you and me could understand, you know.
Gotcha. Okay, so one last dumb question about the movie. Then we can move on to Dionysus and the Keepers. The Keepers of the Flame?
Yeah.
Just to clear it up, there was really no Kraken, right?
Yeah, I don't know where they got that, actually. It's a later, I think it's like Norwegian or something. The sea monster, yeah, that's, I don't know.
So that really has nothing to do with the Greeks, totally made up.
There is a late myth, Apollodorus talks about something from the sea, but there's no actually like fishy monster with, you know, it doesn't exist in the Greek. If you look, Kraken's not a Greek word. And I don't know where the folks at Clash of the Titans pulled that out of, but I think
okay.
I was reading once that it's like a Norse thing or something.
Okay. All right. So you wanted to talk about the Dionysus' followers and how they invented theater and those, and like I said at the top of the hour, those kick-ass women who kick-ass, warriors of the sacred feminine. So where do you want to start?
Yeah, you know, I hope some of your listeners will call in. Because,
yeah, let me give the number again, 718-766-4662.
I'd like to hear from some women out there, because I'd like to hear what they think about the sacred feminine voice here. And I think it's really important. Karen, interrupt me and just let's fire back and forth, because I don't want to lecture. I just want to talk about the topic and get it out there, but not to just ramble on.
Okay, so why are these women of Dionysus, what did you call them, the they kindle the flame, or what was the phrase you used?
Yeah, so these kick-ass women who literally they're women with sticks, I like to call them. When I used to teach mythology, that's what I call them, women with sticks.
Literal sticks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, who could chase down a man and beat the living you-know-what out of him. That's what
okay.
they were, you know. These are women who left their homes, left their families, and went off into the hills to celebrate Dionysus. And apparently the civil authorities had a lot of problems with this in antiquity. The Romans did as well, not only the Greeks but the Romans. They busted up a lot of these gatherings and prosecuted a lot of people who were involved as well. The Romans didn't like this cult activity because it challenged their state power. But anyway, so you got women, followers of Dionysus, and we call them Maenads or Bacchants. Both are fine. But Karen, we don't even know what these words mean. Like the Greek verb bakeo that we get the word Bacchant from, it's always defined as to rave, you know, kind of to rave madly, to run around and make noise and be crazy. You know, well, what is that exactly?
Makes it sound like you're sort of off your rocker or insane, or maybe they were using those good drugs.
Well, we know that the followers were worshiping insanity. They were worshiping mania, like the Maenads being out of their minds. They were worshiping that. And one of the keys that we find in Euripides, near the end of his life, wrote this play called The Bacchae, and he died before it could be put on, so one of his relatives put it on for him. But it's kind of his swan song. And everybody, this is funny because modern scholars all say, well, Euripides was a misogynist, and you know he was a woman hater and a bad guy and whatnot. But the funny thing is, they can't explain this last play of his, this great swan song of his, where he seems to be praising women and the female voice above all else in Greek society. It's really a beautiful play about the true strength of women, and I hope your women out there understand this. And that's why I keep saying, if anybody's going to really save American democracy, it's going to be women. It has to be the voice of women that does it.
So if listeners wanted to read this play, what is it called again?
The Bacchae.
The Bacchae, okay. Well, David, why would the Greeks have revered madness or insanity? Was it because you're kind of thinking outside the box then? I mean, anything is possible?
No, that's
hard to understand.
That's a good question. It is hard for us to understand because we don't. As a Christian society, madness is a bad thing. It's always bad. Right?
Yeah, you get lobotomies for madness.
Exactly. It's embarrassing. It's something bad. And it goes back again to the priestesses of Rhea, again, this Titaness female divinity who is an oracular divinity. These priestesses of Rhea used to walk around in the streets and scream at people. And Nicander is a good source again for this. He compares their activity to what happens when you drink too much of drug X, Y, and Z, that it causes you to walk around screaming. He says this is like the priestesses of Rhea, that they do this. And it was considered a holy act, a completely holy act, that they were out of their minds. Well, keep digging, and what do you find? Well, one of the words for madness that Dionysus induces, that Euripides tells us, is where we get our word estrus. It's the stinging. It literally means to sting in Greek. So there was something that they were doing that had to do with being out of your mind because of a stinging, being driven on by this stinging power that compelled you to go out in the wilderness and have these interactions with women. Well, what's going on actually is that and you can read this in the play, I'm not making this up, that these Maenads, these Bacchants, were performing choruses. And that's what they're doing out in the woods.
So they're singing. That's what the stinging is? Singing?
Exactly. It's not, they're not associated with the words, but the stinging drives them, the madness drives them to the state of frenzy, to the state of ecstatic frenzy. And what do they do when they're in this? They don't just walk around in circles and babble at trees and whatnot. They don't, or as the men at the time thought, they weren't out having sexual orgies. You know, that's what they were afraid they were doing, but they weren't, according to Euripides. They were actually out performing choruses, and that's what the god Dionysus says. That's what Euripides puts into his mouth, because he's in the play, he's one of the characters in the play. He's there to drive women to song.
Okay, don't laugh. I'm going to just throw in an anecdotal story here, okay? When you started talking about this, these women breaking into song, it reminded me when I put together a tour to Egypt, and it was mostly women. We were in the Queen's Chamber of the Great Pyramid.
Okay.
And, you know, it's hard for me to say some of these things, but, you know, I guess my listeners know me by now, so I'll just say it. But sort of out of the corner of my eye, I thought I saw a huge winged image of Isis when we were in the Queen's Chamber for a split second. I mean, I didn't go in there looking for anything like that. The pyramid was the last place I thought I would have any kind of real goddess experience, you know. And what was weird about it, David, was within minutes, less than 5 minutes after that, the women in our group, we started just like simultaneously chanting.
Is that right?
You know, and we didn't even, we hadn't practiced it. I didn't even know that all the women knew the same chant. It felt like something happened.
Did it feel right when you were doing it? Did it feel like, you know, you're supposed to be singing?
Oh, it was joyous,
yeah.
You know. It was joyous. It was beautiful. It felt so good inside. But you couldn't explain how did that happen, you know.
Right. It's almost like you were stung to madness yourselves for a few minutes. You were out of your normal state of mind. You were put into a kind of a state of mind that supported your singing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I can sort of maybe get this on some small, you know, minutia level. I mean, I'm sure for them it was much more grand, but maybe that was a little glimpse.
So how many, let's work with this. How many women did you have?
I think it was about 5 or 6 of us.
Okay. So take those women, take 5 or 6 women and add about 20, 25, okay? Let's bring your numbers up to 30, okay? Put you all in the same clothing, which are fawn skins, okay? You're wearing fawn skin clothing, okay? And then we're going to oil you down with oil containing all sorts of drugs that we haven't figured out what they did yet, okay? So we're going to oil yourselves down with the drugs. We give you a thyrsus. This is a stick. It's a fennel stalk, right? With ivy wound around it, right? You talked earlier about the god of the vine, right? That's Dionysus, the god of the vine. We give you that, and then we give you a leader who's been educated in how to lead a chorus, how to lead a group of women like this in song and dance, and put you in this religious, you're obviously in a religious environment anyway, a sacramental type environment, a sacred environment anyway. So put yourself in this environment with this leader of the chorus and women, now again, who have been trained to sing, who know how to sing. So when you burst into the singing, you burst together and overcome by the madness, be it from the drugs or be it from the circumstances, the religious ceremony. Think about that as a ceremony. What could possibly come out of that?
Well, dare I say, it must have been glorious.
Well, it was so glorious that any men who showed up ended up getting beaten with those sticks. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say why they didn't want onlookers.
No, it was considered an initiatory process. It was men were not allowed to see. It was women only.
So, and in a way, it's sort of like our diluted women's mysteries, which, you know, women are always holding so dear, but, you know, they don't come anywhere close to, I'm sure, what the ancient sacred mysteries really were.
Yeah, I don't know because I haven't been involved in any, but I can tell you for a fact, yeah, when you prohibit, it's a prohibition. Keeping the men out was a prohibition of the masculine. That it was the feminine that was being celebrated. And how do we know that, Karen? Because the god himself who guided all of this was Dionysus, the one god in the Greek pantheon who's called the gynamorph or a thalamorph. There's a couple words. Gyne is woman in Greek, and thalu is feminine. So he's the god with the feminine form. That's the only reason he could guide this whole process, because he was a representative there of the feminine, and I'm arguing of the feminine.
So are we saying he's androgynous?
I don't think that even captures it. I think that's close and saying androgynous, but he actually becomes the female voice himself.
Hmm.
And this is because of his mother. His mother, again, was consumed at his birth because she asked to see the sacred flame. She asked to see essentially, as the people who are writing this talk about, essentially she wanted to see what the universe was in its natural state. She wanted to understand, when I say see, she wanted to take into her mortal self a complete understanding of the universe, that fire that the Greeks said was the place that the gods existed. The place that music exists is fire, right? It's not. It doesn't walk down the street and have an address in New York City, right? Music exists somewhere beyond.
Right.
And their description was that comes out of the fire. Well, how do women draw that music from the cosmos if they can't see the fire and be consumed by the fire? They have to. They have to be driven through the oestrus. They have to be driven into the fire, consumed by it completely, and that's when they scream. Their music is actually a shouting. It's actually oluzzo. It's actually a cry.
Wow. This is some intense stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is, and this is why I want women to be able to see this, because it's not this crying, this screaming, this song, actually becomes the guiding force of Western civilization.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
So, but when you describe it, it sounds chaotic. It doesn't sound. I mean, how then does it morph into something organized and clinical as society? Or am I looking at it wrong?
No, you're not. Because the women are. Remember, it's a group of women. Okay, it's a. We call it a coven. It is the perfect example of how the Christians screw things up. It's translated as a coven. A theosos in Greek is translated as a coven, right? You think a bunch of vampire women or something. No, no, no. Or witches or something, right? That's what you
mm-hmm.
get a negative connotation, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a following. It's a group. It's a chorus. Literally described as a chorus of women. And so imagine this crazy yelling, screaming song produced by 30-some women, led by one woman, all dancing together, Euripides is specific about this, in a choreographed manner, while screaming into existence a song.
Wow.
They create a song, and that song, it says, has a message to it. The message to that song is death to tyranny.
Ugh.
Protect the children.
Ugh. Wow. I mean, that's intense stuff. I mean, and it must, can you imagine if somebody did come upon it, how intimidating it would be? I think it would be scary.
Yeah.
If somebody came upon that sight that you just described.
So what happens in the Bacchae, I'll give it away. What happens when Pentheus, right, there's this king called Pentheus, and he doesn't want the Bacchae, he doesn't want the women to be out there doing what they're doing. He even puts them in chains. He says their voice basically should not be heard. Shut these women up. Put them in chains. And so he wants to go out and see them, and Dionysus leads them out to see these women. And guess what happens? When they see him, what do? They click into step, and this is where I like to talk about the ass-kicking, stick-holding women. They click into martial step. They're described as an army. They have the same discipline as an army, a group of male soldiers would have. They click into step, they come after Pentheus, and they literally tear him limb from limb.
Well, that sounds like some crazy women.
yeah, exactly. But why are they there in the first place? Why are they tearing him apart in the first place? Because he is trying to stifle their voice. And nature itself screams through these women. It feeds into these women and comes out and destroys this man who is trying to prevent them, who's basically trying to imprison them.
Wow. Well, this gives a whole new twist or meaning to being the voice for the sacred feminine.
Yeah.
I mean, just on a whole nother level. And, you know, and I can almost see that where men might really want to stifle this. You know, they might not like the idea of this. And, you know, here maybe I'm going Christian and patriarchal again, but, you know, maybe this was intimidating and, you know, they wanted their power and how dare they, you know, we're not going to listen to them kind of a thing. But then I guess if you've come at it from the standpoint that they were honoring nature, well, then it was just sort of the natural state of things. I guess it varied.
Right. It's why the cult of Dionysus is one of the oldest. It's found in the Linear B tablets. That's old, like a precursor of Greek. And the cult of Dionysus is there from the beginning. And it's, you know, the Greeks had an incredible respect for, hey, if it's a natural phenomenon, you can't stifle it. But Karen, I want to take it and translate it into the modern day shoe leather. This is something that the Greeks believed. They actively worshiped the god Dionysus. They didn't just believe that women at one time in their past had done this. They actually went out and did it because they thought that it gave women a power that would assist their society. And this is something I've been thinking. If I can stay on the subject but talk about something that's not Greek for a second.
Sure.
I saw three, and again, interrupt and ask questions because you're the one who keeps this on track. I saw three things that have really disturbed me, and it's really stuck in my head, images that I can't get out of my mind. One was in a video that they discovered it's a World War II footage from World War II. I think it was Iwo Jima or Okinawa. And when the American soldiers landed, to make a long story short, there was an engagement at night. The American Army thought it was being engaged by the Japanese, and instead it was a bunch of the local islanders who were trying to get away from the Japanese. The Americans fired on them and killed a bunch of people, and the next morning when the sun was rising, they were going over the bodies, and there was this about a six-year-old girl who was sitting in the middle of these bodies, just shaking, obviously in shock. An American soldier leans over to her and tries to give her a drink out of his canteen, and she's so in shock she didn't even take it. It's absolutely one of the most horrific sights I've ever seen. Image number two, a girl in Vietnam. We've all seen this one. I just saw this one about 2 weeks ago. A girl in Vietnam. Remember the pictures? American soldiers are marching up to this village that had just been napalmed, and this girl comes running out. She's probably about, I don't know, 9 or 10 years old. And her back is completely burnt off. The skin is completely gone. It's just raw. It's just raw meat on her back. So you know she died. But the look on her face, again, is a look of complete horror. It's a look of she's trying to get help and nobody is helping her, and she's obviously in shock. Picture number three, something that was just published on the New York Times by the New York Times. You can go to YouTube and see this. It's video footage from an Apache helicopter where a group of guys, this is a questionable death scenario, there are a group of guys, a couple of them were photographers. The Apache helicopter's pilots thought that they had an RPG. They mistook this guy's camera for an RPG, and they shot the hell out of these guys, just destroyed them all. And this van comes up in a minute, and they shoot the van up too. Well, then the soldiers arrive, and again, you can see this all in the footage. The soldiers arrive on the ground, and they pull two little kids out of this van.
Dead? And,
they said they were wounded, but they're languished. They're not moving in their arms, and you can see the soldiers carrying these two little children out of this vehicle that they had just shot the hell out of. And the pilot comments. He says, "Well, that'll teach them not to bring their kids to a battle, won't it?"
This is where they live.
right. And this is the point. This is the point exactly. The terror that is in the eyes of those children is a voice that a woman must voice in order to protect them. It is a scream. It is a cry. And that's what I think the Greeks understood. Somehow the feminine voice was able to tap into a force in the universe to prevent men from creating this horror.
Hmm. It's almost, maybe, but not exactly, almost like a sacred rage.
Exactly.
A sacred rage, or almost like, I'm trying to think of, it's so hard to language, maybe it's almost like I keep wanting to say like a buffer, a protection. It's like a warning, kind of a thing. It's like a, do not trespass kind of a thing. Don't you dare. I don't know. Those are just sort of the words that, that are coming to mind as I'm hearing you say this responsibility that, to protect, to nurture, to make sure man's insanity doesn't, drive us over the edge kind of a thing.
Exactly. It's almost like it's a divine, it's almost like it's a divine or natural force that lives within the female voice that can be voiced. And that's what the Greeks were trying to teach, how to voice this, how to bring this, how to bring up women. And you know what? They had to educate them. They had to teach them astronomy and geometry. These women had to teach each other astronomy and geometry in order to figure out how to access, how to really stand up in these choruses and stand against this destructive masculine force that brings I'll never forget looking at that kid on Iwo Jima, or I can't remember, Iwo Jima or Okinawa, where it was. I'll never forget that little girl, the look in her eyes. Never. It's an image that's burned into my head, and I'll see it for the rest of my life. And that's what I think that voice produces. It produced something that stuck in the Greek psyche that they could not get rid of. It was a horrific defensive, like you say, a defensive a voice that the woman was capable of. It kept tyranny from the pages of history. And
you know,
I don't see that.
It's almost a roar. I mean, I'm feeling it. It's almost like a roar. I'm thinking Sekhmet's roar,
Yeah. You're always right on. You're always right on, because that's Bromius. The name Bromius, it means the roar. Yeah. That's
well, and I can see where we have lost that voice. Women have, instead of being the protector, after so much Christianity, so much patriarchy, women are no longer the protectors. Instead, they have been oppressed. They have not been the shero, saying no, this is intolerable. Instead, they are the ones at the margins of society and so many cultures that and have become the victims instead of the protector.
Yeah, and maybe that's why society. Well, maybe that's why our society is in the shape that it's in. Where are the women roarers? And that's what I wanted to ask your women tonight. I wish you would call in. I wish they would call in and tell us, where are the women roarers?
Well, I'll probably get emails like I usually do afterwards. So, but David, we are starting to run out of time, and I want to make sure if you had any other important points that we that we got them in. But this, you've mentioned the voice, the cry, and I feel most comfortable saying the roar. That feels really true in my gut. You've mentioned it to me before, but I think tonight is the first time I've really got it. I think it's that aha moment. I think you reached me tonight with, that meaning and intention of the Greeks, and
it
I'm going to keep thinking about this.
It wasn't me, Karen, because you're the one who came up with the word roar, and that's actually another name for Dionysus. I'm not kidding you. You're the one who accessed that, not me. And again, it's not male leadership that's important. What is important is the accessing of that female voice. And that female voice can only be accessed by a woman who understands, or who comes to a point that she can see the flame. According to the Greeks, I don't know, that's just what I'm saying, that she can see the fire of existence.
Okay. In my mind, I guess, you know, because it's familiar, I keep going back to Sekhmet, you know, because, and I know Sekhmet's Egyptian, she's not Greek, but I think about she's the lioness, she's the mother. She can kill you in an instant if you threaten her child, but she's also the protector. You know, she's the one that's going to go out and get the food. You know, she's the one that's going to hold you in, you know, the protection of her embrace. But, you know, she is going to roar if threatened. And I don't know, I just, that makes sense to me, especially today, because, you know, women look to Sekhmet as sort of an archetype of empowerment. So it's not Greek, but I think it's a good parallel.
Yeah, no, I it sounds like a beautiful parallel to me. And what I want to know from you, though, Karen, is where are these followers of Sekhmet? Where is the voice? Where is the roar that we need in this world, in this society? You know, you talk about the Dalai Lama, and he's a great guy. I've listened to him. I like him a lot. He says a Western woman is going to save society, is going to save civilization. Where the hell is the Western woman? Where is she? What is her? Where is her? Look at our lives.
I'm ready to march in the street, David.
Yeah. Well, you better start leading them.
Well, you know, I say that myself too, you know, and I don't always feel like things are moving quickly enough. I know when I teach classes, you know, sometimes the women, you know, they're just not anywhere near this point yet, you know. They don't realize their own strength, their own value, you know.
Exactly. They're in chains, aren't they? They're in chains, aren't they, Karen? They don't understand their own capacity.
They don't. They're in chains. They are wounded. They are fighting each other rather than the forces they ought to be putting their fighting energy toward, if that makes any sense. You know, we have a lot of work to do as women, and I think there probably are a lot of women out there. I think of Eve Ensler. I think of Hillary Clinton. I know there are a lot of women out there whose names escape me right now, Jean Shinoda Bolen, but there needs to be more. And
do you think you could take not just the Hillary Clintons and the women who are in power now, who are the Nancy Pelosi's, who have some sort of power? Do you think, Karen, you could take 25 women off the street in L.A. where you are? Do you think you could take 25 girls who are willing, who are willing to access that voice and give them that voice? Do you think you could do that?
Well, I'll tell you. I don't know whether I mentioned to you, I've been teaching Cakes for the Queen of Heaven.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Those women have shifted in where they were from the day they walked in that class to our midpoint in the series. Those women are changing, but they had to have access to this information. The problem is too many women don't have access. You know, they're still caught up in the paradigm, you know, that most of us have been caught up in for way too long. So I think, to answer your question, I think it can be done, but there's going to, you know, there needs to be more teachers out there that are representative of this voice to give it to women so that they can take it back.
Yeah, and I think but you think the potential is there, like among your listeners? I mean,
I think so. I mean, I look at the women on Facebook, you know, who, you know, I'll put up something and, you know, so many of them are right there behind me. You know, they're signing petitions. They're forwarding around information. You know, it's not as huge as I'd like it to be, but, they're getting it. You know, I think slowly more and more women are finding their voice. You know, they have to, but I think one of the biggest keys is they have to learn that they have to step up, that, you know, they can't wait for somebody else. They have to find that voice within themselves, that outrage, that sacred rage,
right.
You know, that I'm filled with every day I turn on the news, you know, mm-hmm. that creates my What's the Buzz segment, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But so many of us are just so caught up on this, you know, hamster wheel, you know, and, you know, it it's like we're programmed. You know, society has us programmed with our nose to the grindstone so we don't look around and reclaim that sacred rage and that powerful voice.
You have to dig deep into the ground. You have to, you know, for some reason these women, these Bakkens and Menads, these who are crazed and they're accessing this voice, they're associated with getting in touch with the earth. They have to be brought back to the earth. They have to be brought back to their native. It's like you're saying, Karen, it's almost like you have to strip away. See, you're the minister and you're the one who does this stuff. You know, I'm just talking about theory, but you actually put it into practice. Can you take these women and get them in touch with this, like strip away this Christian training and strip away the societal training and get them in touch with the earth so that they actually, do you think you could make a chorus of women? Do you think you could lead them?
I think if we could have a retreat for a month, yeah. But, you know, it's the idea. It's almost like, I hate to use the word indoctrination, but it's almost like you have, it would be hard. You know, you have to be, I think, taken out of your, you know, this environment that we live in every day, you know. You can't, work an eight-hour job and have to worry about feeding the husband and the kids. You know, I think it would almost be like, going to boot camp or something. I hate to use these militaristic terms, but it would be, let's call it college. You know, it would be goddess college. It would be...
There you go. Why don't you start a goddess college? Why don't you start with the sole purpose of creating a chorus of women who will scream out the old order, who will put to music the beauty of the earth, and will destroy, with their voices, will destroy what's going on. Could you do that?
You're being my muse now. Don't you're getting the juices flowing. You're making my brain cook.
I think you could figure it out, Karen. I think you could. I think it's in you. I think it's in you to do that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, we haven't talked much about this because, you know, I've been so focused on learning as much as you could teach me about the Greeks. But, you know, the Goddess Temple down in Orange County is a great place for women to start to find their value and find their voice. And, you know, it's only been in existence for 7 years, but they are gradually growing and growing. And if we had something like that in every neighborhood, you know, or as the foundress down there says, you know, if women could find their queen, you know, to that would go along with this idea of their maiden mother crone, once they could find their queen. And that's sort of that too, you know, because the queen's the one that looks after her realm. You know, she's the one that is the protector. She's the caretaker. And that would be this archetype too, you know, that we're talking about. These are ideas that are, I think they're right there under the surface, you know, and I'm hoping that they're going to explode forth in my lifetime.
How about this? How about if we issue a challenge to your listeners? And I know you want to get to your buzz section, and that's actually, to me, the most informative section, so I'm going to let you get to it, but because I want to hear it. But what if we ask for volunteers from your audience? What if we say, you know, hey, if you're out there and you're a woman and you're listening to this and you have an ability to know that you want to see that fire. You want to see that flame of existence, just like Semele, the mother of Dionysus. You want to be the chorus. You want to stand up against the
oppression.
The awful oppression and murder that's going on in the world. Send us an email. Send Karen an email. Send her an email. Say, I want to be a member of this special chorus, and I'll come out to Orange County, and let's get things going. I mean, I'm serious. It's, you know, there's potential there. This is not just theoretical. You know,
I know what you're talking about. I seriously do. You know, I mean, a lot of us, you know, we carry this in us. You know, we're passionate about it. You know, this is what we feel like we were, you know, this is what this life is about for us, you know. So I'm game.
I hope so. I hope they respond. I know they're out there. Okay, I'm
well,
gonna,
Well, David, thank you. And listen, one of our listeners emailed a special request before I get into the What's the Buzz segment. She asked in a past show, I think it was when we were talking about Aphrodite, you were going to talk about the rose. And she asked that you please share what it was you wanted to say about Aphrodite and the rose. Do you remember?
Yeah, the rose is that flame. The rose is that sacred flame of Aphrodite. The rose always has a special association with Aphrodite. And I can tell you on a technical level that it's used in lots and lots of drug recipes. The rose oil is a suspension that can basically pull out, as a lipid, can pull out active secondary metabolites from plants. Drugs, in other words, to do different all sorts of things. So it's a suspension for drugs. It's a pharmaceutical mainstay. But more important, the rose is always a symbol of the power of Aphrodite. There's some special connection there between the blossoming of a rose and life itself. And I think it was Sintra that was asking this question. When you're asking, I'm going to talk to her now, ready? I'm just talking to her, the person who asked this question. When you're asking about the rose, you are asking about the flame of Aphrodite. If you're searching for the flame, you are searching for that female voice. And guess what? You'll find in the Euripides Bacchae that the followers of Dionysus were being led to Aphrodite. Read it. I'm not making it up. It's not just happenstance. It's there. So when you ask about the rose, you are asking about following that voice to your flame, to that flame, to accessing that flame. It's in the rose.
So somehow Dionysus' followers were also connected to Aphrodite.
Yes, and you read Euripides' Bacchae. You'll find it. There every time. And again, I can talk, stupid scholarly about how oracular religions and what this is going to do. But talking to the person who sent that question in, I'm just telling you, if you're searching for the rose, look through the Maenads, look through the Bacchants. Look to the flame that consumed the mother of Dionysus, because that's what you're looking for. That's why you're attracted to that rose. Anyway.
So you think of a rose as definitely something beautiful, but something delicate. It almost seems the opposite of a flame.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. We think of it as delicate, but remember to these women who are actually putting this in their hair, that's an active drug. It's a component of their whole ceremony that puts them into a mood of craziness.
Ah, so we're looking at the rose simply as this delicate flower, not the essence that it creates.
Right. No, for the Greeks, that was and I'm saying Greek women. For these Greek women who are going through the ceremony of Dionysus, that rose to them is a profoundly potent, powerful, like a fire-possessed plant. It's not the rose of, let's give each other a rose on Valentine's Day and feel good about each other, and what's in a rose and all that. No, this is something far more earth-connected, far more, let me say one more thing, and I'll shut up. I'm taking all the time, I'm sorry. But let me say one more thing. There's a story, The Rose and the Nightingale, which talks about the nightingale is always a symbol in antiquity of the muse. And the only way to create a rose is for the nightingale to press her heart against the rose of the thorn in the moonlight. Okay? The only way for her to produce the rose is to give her heart's blood to the rose. Okay? And this is a story, The Nightingale and the Rose. What is the name of the person who asked you this question?
It was Sintra.
Sintra. Okay, here I'm going to give Sintra an assignment. I hope Sintra becomes one of your chorus members. she's probably got it in her. I want you to go look up The Nightingale and the Rose, okay? And I want you to read it. It's a short story. And I'm going to give you, because I always forget his name, Wilde. It's Oscar Wilde. A short story by Oscar Wilde. If you read that, Oscar Wilde, of course, everybody knows he was gay and he went to prison because he was gay. He was the gynomorph. He was more of a gynomorph. Okay, take it for what it is. He's the Dionysus. He understood something that the Greeks, as somebody who studied this stuff, anyway, he understood what was going on, the big picture-wise. Read The Nightingale and the Rose, Kintra. Try to understand what that rose really means and follow it.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sure she'll email us because she's been a follower of all your interviews, David. Thank you. Well, we have about 15 minutes left for the show, and we are going to get to as much of What's the Buzz as we can tonight. But it's been great conversation, and as always, David, thank you. But for our first What's the Buzz topic, it was about this article in the Washington Post, and it's actually all over the evening news tonight, that the Virginia Governor Robert F. McDonnell, his original Confederate History Month proclamation. He issued this proclamation saying that April 2010 and declares it Confederate History Month in the Commonwealth. The declaration, which had been refused under previous Democratic governors, was not well received by many Virginia residents, including a woman by the name of Sheila Johnson, a prominent African-American backer from 2008. She described the proclamation as not only academically flawed, but personally offensive, as she should have. McDonnell later issued a strongly worded apology and inserted a new paragraph into the original proclamation, referring to the horrors and pains and slavery in the Commonwealth during the Confederacy. But what was really happening here was they were using selective memory, shall I say. They weren't thinking about the horrors of being a black person in Confederate United States. They were just thinking about, being the white landowner and what that was like. If you go on the internet, you can see the proclamation, and it talks all about how the Virginians were overwhelmed by the insurmountable numbers and resources of the Union Army, but yet they survived and they were imprisoned and how they suffered and all of that. But it's just interesting that, here this Virginia governor could be talking about Confederate History Month and totally leave out the idea of, what the Civil War was fought over and the horrors and pains of slavery. It's just unfathomable to me. But at the same time, we keep seeing this happening over and over and over, this rewriting of history, this distortion of knowledge and truth, and it just sort of makes me crazy. And it's also the topic of the article that Karma sent in to me. She sent me this article that says, when I was young, Ike was president. I could never imagine why he was so popular. Maybe this has something to do with it, because General Eisenhower warned us. It's a matter of history that when the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces, General Dwight Eisenhower, found victims of the death camps, he ordered all possible photographs be taken and for the German people from surrounding villages to be ushered through the camps and even made to bury the dead. He did this because he said in his words to this effect, "Get it on record now, get the films, get the witnesses, because somewhere down the road, someone is going to get up and say that this never happened." Well, apparently, there are people that are already saying that, besides the Holocaust didn't happen, that's not nothing new. We've been hearing the Aryan Nation and people like that who've said the Holocaust didn't happen for some time now. But apparently, they're talking about how long will it be before the attack on the World Trade Center will become like the Holocaust. People will be asking, did it really happen? So anyway, it makes me think about how the Texas Board of Education is trying to rewrite the books down there so that it just has this conservative history. Makes me think about George Bush and his cronies. It makes me think about Fox News. It's just so important. We have to stay so diligent to protect history, protect knowledge, protect truth, and not let it be hijacked. Also, let's see, the next thing coming up in What's the Buzz is what the health care bill actually means for women. I'm just going to mention a few of these because it's a little bit long and I don't want to leave Sarah Palin out tonight. I can't do that. Anyway, health care bill, what it means for women. Contraceptives are covered, which means millions more women will gain access to family planning. Basic benefits include preventive care such as pap tests and mammograms without copays or deductibles. Gender rating, the practice of charging women more for the same coverage, will be eliminated for individuals and workplaces with under 100 employees. Discrimination in favor of higher paid employees will also be banned, so employers will not be able to give lesser plans to lower paid workers who are more likely to be women and people of color. The executive order promised that Obama promised to sign in order to gain the votes of Representative Bart Stupak, the Democrat from Michigan, and other anti-choice Democrats, will implement the compromise abortion restrictions proposed by Senator Ben Nelson. Abortions cannot be covered by any federal subsidy or funding in accordance with the Hyde Amendment, but individuals may buy insurance plans that offer abortion coverage as long as they pay for it with their own money. I think that's all I'm going to read on this right now, but it's easy enough to find. You can just go to the Ms. Magazine blog. They're a good source of information. They also had on their blog what Prop 8 defenders don't want you to see. Well, many of you probably know all the money that that poured into California, mostly in large part by paid for by the Mormon Church. And Proposition 8, which was to ban same-sex marriage, well, they went to court, and there's a pending decision about this trial that happened earlier in the year. And as someone who closely followed the trial on sites such as Prop 8 Trial Tracker and Fire Dog Lake, we find out what the deliberate efforts to mislead voters were in order to get their vote to vote against Prop 8. These are some of the things that they actually told people in order to get them to vote against same-sex marriage. They said, the myth number one, banning same-sex marriage protects children. Myth number two, same-sex marriage will harm straight marriages. Myth three, Prop 8 campaign was not about homophobia. Myth four, same-sex marriage will change an institution that has remained stable throughout the ages. I mean, these were the things that, you know, this was the propaganda they were telling people to take the rights away from gay Americans, and it's just appalling. But Sarah Palin, she's back on television. What's the harm? This is also from the Ms. Magazine blog. Well, to get right down to it, what this writer of the blog is saying, and I have to agree, by allowing fallen politicians to enter the media spotlight from a single angle, from a different angle, a wholly unpolitical, inoffensive angle, we sort of allow them to appear declawed or harmless, perhaps even charming. And that's the fear with Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin's Alaska might foster a false sense of normalcy about the host, which will coax viewers to let down their guard and forget what she's really about, which is about anti-choice, pro-gun, homophobic rhetoric. And let's not forget, her church is at war with the Queen of Heaven. And in case you don't know, the Queen of Heaven is the goddess. So we have to remain alert. We can't just think of her as this winking, folksy, you betcha gal. I think we really have to keep our eye on her and make sure she doesn't get in a position to make laws that affect you and I. And let's see, finally, I wanted to share something that, again, on the Ms. Magazine blog, I spent a lot of time on there the last few days. This woman wrote in who, and she wrote on the blog, her name is Jean, And she says, "Dear Bart Stupak, welcome to the club." Now, just a reminder, Bart Stupak, he's the guy that held the health care bill hostage as he tried to get stronger abortion restrictions in the bill. He's the Democrat. He's the one that's hooked up with C Street that you've heard me talk about in the past, that that secretive Christian political organization in Washington, and he's under scrutiny right now because he might have actually got subsidized housing and didn't report it on his taxes and all of that. But anyway, Jean, who ran an abortion clinic for 9 years, and she's defended clinics across the nation, writes this open public letter to Bart Stupak and says, "Welcome to the club. I've worn a bulletproof vest just to go to work. My car was routinely vandalized. My house was firebombed. I was stalked. I received so many telephone death threats, including one delivered to my kid when I couldn't come to the phone, that I considered them routine. And it wasn't just me who was threatened. My son was shot at. My husband was routinely targeted. My kids grew up never opening or even touching any package that came in the mail, dealing with harassment at Sunday school and elsewhere, and always watching their backs. Now, Bart, you and other anti-abortion Democrat members of Congress have joined this club. You are now on the receiving end of the thrown rocks, the telephone threats, and the ominous personal visits from people who, oddly enough, share your anti-abortion sentiments. They're just mad about your vote for health care reform. So I thought I'd put problems aside and offer you some advice." Well, she goes on and does give him some advice, but just to sum it up, not that she's advocating anything happen to Bart Stupak. It's just, the fear, hate, and bigotry that's being ginned up by the GOP and Fox News. It's just bad, and it's never okay to threaten these people or threaten, to harm them. But, she's asking him, "How does it feel to know that you helped create these people through your leadership against women in favor of bishops, your support of the anti-abortion movement, and your discounting of women's lives and women's choices?" Jean says to Bart, "You stood silent while women were attacked and doctors were murdered. Now your people are coming for you. You should have spoken out, but you didn't." And I have to agree with Jean. Maybe now he's getting a little taste of what it's been like, to be someone who supports choice. And because, after all, we can't forget that abortion is still a freedom in this country, despite the crazed opposition that would take away women's rights. So we are coming to the end of the show. I'm sorry I had to rush that What's the Buzz. We only have a few minutes left. But what I'd like to do is just kind of slow things down a little bit. We have about 3 minutes left. And I'm just going to close the hour off. We've had so much information. Just want us to sort of come together and refocus and take a breath. And just listen, close your eyes as I read this closing prayer that comes from the Goddess Temple down in Orange County, just to sort of close off all of the conversation and dialogue from this evening. Great Goddess, the life force in all quickens within as the season lifts from the dark of winter to the growing light of spring. With gentle anticipation, I feel myself enlivening in a fresh new way, once again expecting powerful and good things to continue to blossom in my life, just as spring will blossom into the fruiting of the summer. I am deeply grateful for my part in the great wheel of life. I stand in reverence to all forms of you. Thank you, Mother, and blessed be. Well, listeners, that's the end of our show for tonight. And remember, we do not have a show next Wednesday. The next show will be April 21st, our Earth Day show. So please check out the archives. Email me. Let me know if you want to be part of the chorus. And we always love hearing your feedback. So please let us hear from you. And until we meet again, may she of 10,000 names embrace you in her golden wings. Good night. That's it.